Monster Professor.
I should have music like that every time I enter a room. Like when I get into a real classroom, that's what should play every single time. Well, welcome to the Monster Professor, the show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, film, games, folklore, culture, and beyond. We're going to dig deep, so be prepared. I'm your host, Josh Woods. I'm an author, editor, professor, and now some kind of self-proclaimed monster expert, calling himself the Monster Professor. Thanks for joining us. In our last episode, we started Monsters in Literature. I think it's going to take 3 episodes to get through all of them. The general game plan is let's cover chronologically the most significant monsters in literature. We started with Epic of Gilgamesh, our first story as human beings that we have recorded, all the way up through Beowulf. In this episode, I want to go to what I consider stage 2 of monsters in literature. That first one was an ancient kind of pagan stage. Now with Christianity and Western civilization, we get into medieval, late medieval, early modern. I'm going to try to get all the way up to modern in this episode. So what I consider to be stage 2 and 3. So let's jump right into Dante's Inferno. What do you say? That comes to us from about AD 1320, and there are so many monsters in the Inferno. We could call them demons. I think they fit every qualification of also being called monsters. The one that stood out to me the most when I read the Inferno was Dante's version of Cerberus. We can pronounce it Cerberus. I think perhaps the original Greek was Cerberus. I grew up with it being called Cerberus, so I'm probably just going to default to that. So first, the original Greek Cerberus was the gatekeeper of the underworld, a dog at the gates of hell. And the original Cerberus had 50 heads. Later, he got reduced down to 3 heads. Some suspect that that's because 3 heads were easier to carve and paint than 50 heads. And then the 3 heads, at one point or another, started becoming associated with notions of, in your death, having to face your past, your present, and your future, or something to that effect. But I always imagined Cerberus to be very much like a dog. That's what struck me so much about Dante's version of Cerberus. In this one, he is more like a big, gross, redneck werewolf. He's got a pot belly, he's greasy, he's got a beard, and he is the Lord Tormentor over the third circle of the Inferno. That's the one where they throw everybody who is guilty of the sin of gluttony. Well, let's just get right to it. Here's what the Inferno says about him. The weird and savage Cerberus is there, his 3 throats barking dog-like at the dead, who lie submerged, sodden everywhere, with a black and greasy beard, eyes burning red, gross belly, and huge claw-like hands. He flogs and flays and quarters and rips them all to shreds. The great worm Cerberus saw us at once, bared his fangs of his 3 mouths, and never ceased moving his limbs, all quivering and tense. My master stretched his open hands and seized great clumps of earth, and quickly flung the foul goblets right down the throats of the greedy beast, just as a hungry hound begins to howl and then grows quiet when his food is thrown to him and strains at it with a low growl. So too the demon Cerberus's own smeared face is hushed, that otherwise would roar to make the dead wish they were deaf as stone. That's pretty cool. So one big question is, of all the possible types of demons that Dante could have put in charge of the third circle for gluttony, why did he choose the Greek monster Cerberus, who was the gatekeeper of the dead? I mean, there's something about perhaps dog-like hunger and that association with gluttony, but there seems to be more to it. If Dante is the genius that we know him to be, then there were probably many, many layers of that. So one clue is thinking about what the sin of gluttony actually is. There are a lot of smart people who say the sin of gluttony is essentially the sin of solitary self-indulgence. What that means is the sin of hunkering down over the thing that gives you immediate satisfaction and gobbling it all up, having no concern with any other living creature or your effect on anything else in the world. I think bound up with that, I would include excess. And so the sin of gluttony could be seen as the gateway sin to all other sins. I mean, what sin could you possibly find yourself in that didn't at some earlier stage start out as a type of solitary self-indulgence excess, a little bit too much of something, wanting some type of immediate hedonistic pleasure without any concern about its effect or your effect on anyone else or anything else, and just gobbling that up for yourself? That could lead to something else, that could lead to something else, until you're what? You're murdering people, you're betraying others, the deeper sins. And so if it's gluttony could be perhaps conceived of as a gateway sin, and I think that has something to do with Dante's choice about taking the gatekeeper of hell and making him Lord Tormentor over the circle of hell for gluttony.
Hell, by the way, is fascinating in all its iterations, and we definitely need a future podcast only on hell itself. So many cool things to say about it. For now, let's just stay in hell. The literature of this era, some of the coolest literature anyways, wants to keep us in hell for quite a bit. So let's go to 1667, Paradise Lost by John Milton. Man, this one's cool. I had no idea what I was getting myself into when I started reading this. I thought I was getting into some type of flowery, sermon-like poem, and very quickly, in Paradise Lost, stuff gets weird and cool and crazy fast. I immediately thought of Harold Bloom's brilliant mention of the experience of reading great literature always hits you with a sense of overwhelming weirdness. Sooner or later, when you're reading these canonical works, you move from that kind of expected, almost boredom appreciation of something great, like a lot of people wander around museums with that kind of attitude or atmosphere, like, yeah, it's great, but it's kind of low-key. And sooner or later, you're struck with this feeling of, what in the hell am I reading right now? This is freaky. And it is. The coolest stuff really gets freaky, and those are very often the things that become canonical. And Paradise Lost, no exception. The moment that really got me was when a huge monster fight started breaking out. I had no idea who these other monsters were. Satan is sneaking his way out of hell, gets all the way to the inner gates of hell, and then there before him stand these two things, and they're going to have a throwdown, and it's a showdown, old school. Here's what they look like. The one seemed woman to the waist and fair, but ended foul in a many a scaly fold, voluminous and vast, a serpent armed with mortal sting. About her middle, round, a cry of hellhounds never ceasing barked with wide Cerebian mouths, full and loud, and rung a hideous peal. Yet, when they list, would creep if aught disturbed their noise into her womb and kennel there, yet still barked and howled within unseen. The other shape, if shape it might be called, that shape had none distinguishable in member, joint, or limb, or substance might be called, that shadow seemed, for each seemed either black it stood as night, fierce as ten furies, terrible as hell, and shook a dreadful dart, what seemed his head, the likeness of a kingly crown, had on. So Satan's on his way to escape, and at the gate stand these two crazy-looking things, and they won't let him pass. And he's like,
oh, you don't know who I am, so you better stand aside. And they're like, no, you don't know who we are. No one passes. And it's a full-on standoff, and they're going to completely destroy each other until the woman steps in between and goes, hey, hold on. We're all family. And Satan's like, say what now? And sure enough, the woman is Sin, and that other shadowy figure that he's going to square off with, who has a spear, he's Death. And Sin helps Satan remember how all this went down when he was still an angel in heaven before he's thrown out. Sin springs out of his forehead, like Athena from Zeus's head. She springs out of his forehead, and so very soon after that, Satan chases her down and rapes her and impregnates her with this crazy type of monster. That thing is born, and that is Death. And so Satan here is encountering at the gates of hell, the two powerful creatures there to stop him are his daughter and kind of lover, I guess, if in a Satan way, and also his son / grandson. It's freaky. And so Satan goes, oh, they're family. Well, how about this? Hey, if you let me out, I'll just sneak right out the gate, and then you can close it right back after I'm gone. They're like, okay, that sounds good. And so they don't end up fighting. They let him sneak out of the gate, but once it's open, there's no closing it back, and so everybody gets out. I think in a future episode, we're going to have to dig into different concepts of Satan and the devil and stuff like this, and definitely Milton's version of Satan is the most iconic. In fact, that's the one that seems to shape everybody's current notion of Satan, even in, I would say, in a lot of religious circles, what they think Satan is and what they think Satan's story is actually John Milton's story for Satan and John Milton's version of Satan. I mentioned Harold Bloom earlier, and he posited that Milton took his version of Satan from Shakespeare's Iago, and I think there's some evidence of that. Ever so briefly, we can say that this Satan is a brilliant Enlightenment thinker. He's smart, he's eloquent, he's political, and in heaven, as he starts up the rebellion, he fights against the privileged tyranny, and he is the perfect expression of pure intellect, pure rationality. And the rallying speech he gives in heaven that gets the other angels, or at least a third of them, on his side, ready to take up arms against God and Jesus and the whole heavenly tyranny, that speech is, that could have had Thomas Jefferson's name at the bottom of it, or John Adams' name at the bottom of it. It's this brilliant Enlightenment era speech, totally convincing. Some say Satan was John Milton's great true invention, because it wouldn't have been a great Satan for Milton if he didn't find it compelling and tempting himself. And so he made Satan far and above the most compelling character. You really root for him in Paradise Lost. It's too bad things kind of don't go his way. Is it okay that I root for Satan, by the way? Am I allowed to do that? I'm the Monster Professor. I can root for whoever I want to. Let's call that the end of stage 2 of Monsters in Literature. I think we can say this stage is Monster as Religious Consequence. Stage 2, Monsters as Religious Consequence. In this stage, unlike stage 1, monsters are no longer these completely external outside beings who exist in and of themselves, kind of like beasts. Instead, now, monsters are personifications of human sins and human flaws. And whatever this human sin is gives a certain type of birth to this thing that is its own creature, but not entirely separated from what we do. So now the lines begin to blur. Are these monsters outside forces? Or are they inside forces? Like Cerberus, gluttony. Did our gluttony create the creature? Or did that creature give us gluttony? Same thing with sin. Same thing with death. Same thing even with Satan in a way. So now that the lines begin to blur, did we make the monsters? Stage 2 makes us have to wonder. Time out for a tangent.
How about a mix of personal story tangent and question from the audience? I often get questions from my students asking me, well, Professor Woods, what religion are you? And I've been accused of being a part of many different religions that would in no way be compatible. That's always kind of entertaining to me. And they especially ask that if they hear me offhandedly say anything like, oh, I rooted for Satan in Paradise Lost, or when they hear me draw up examples from biblical stories. They very much want to pinpoint what kind of category I am, as if it's not good enough to just really like the literature that you're reading. And perhaps that's a type of category, although I'm not necessarily even saying that. In fact, here's an example of what I think about categories. A brilliant writer, one of my favorite essayists of all time, Jorge Luis Borges. An Argentine writer, he's known for his primarily for his poetry and his short fiction, but I fell in love with his essays. He gives us the best, I would say, concrete way to think about categories, or at least when I saw this, this is what I think. So he supposedly quotes this from some document found by a Dr. Franz Kuhn, and this is from the Chinese Encyclopedia titled The Heavenly Emporium of Benevolent Knowledge. And I think there's even some reason to think that Dr. Franz Kuhn made that up, or that Borges made up, that this guy made up this thing. And they're all layers of lies in this, and that's even more hilarious to me. And so out of this emporium of benevolent knowledge, here are the ancient Chinese categories of animals. It reads, animals are divided into the following categories. A. Those that belong to the emperor. B. Embalmed ones. C. Those that are trained. D. Suckling pigs. E. Mermaids. F. Fabulous ones. G. Stray dogs. H. Those that are included in this classification. I. Those that tremble as if they were mad. J. Innumerable ones. K. Those drawn by a very fine camel hair's brush. L. Etc. M. Those that have broken a flower vase. And N. Those that at a distance resemble flies. So, there's my answer to what religion I am. Tangent done. Let's move ahead in time to stage 3 of Monsters in Literature. And imagine this. Imagine a volcano erupts somewhere on planet Earth that is so massive that the clouds change the weather across a whole continent, so much so that it stays so cold they call it the year without summer. And take a handful of socially edgy aristocrats going on holiday, going on vacation to a secluded chateau, and they want a kind of outside, outdoor, interactive experience with nature, because they're like that, but because it's the year without summer, it's dark and it's stormy, and so they're trapped in this secluded, large chateau, and in the year without summer, and it's raining and it's thundering, they don't know how else to entertain themselves. And so one of them gets up and says, let's have a ghost story competition. Out of this night, out of this one horror story competition, are born two of the most iconic monsters since, well, just the two most iconic monsters. That's just that.
the people I'm talking about in this chateau in the Year Without Summer, that's 1816, Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin, Percy Bysshe Shelley, Lord Byron, and John Polidori. They had an odd kind of tangle of relationships among each other, and apparently one that lends itself well to creativity, because Mary went upstairs and started composing Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus. John Polidori went off to compose a story in which he created the first real cohesive image of a vampire, or a vampire story. We'll get to that one in just a moment. Let's focus on Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus, the subtitle. I guess by going off into that tangent like I did, I threw away a great segue. We left off stage two by now seeing monsters move from external, beast-like, chaotic forces coming to attack to now these things that are blurring the line between us and them, leaving us to wonder, did we create these monsters? That leads us in many ways, not only in this discussion, but the mindset of people following literature and creating it themselves, like Mary Wollstonecraft, and we know her now as Mary Shelley, because, you know, she married the dude she was there having an affair with in that chateau that night, it leads her to create the major wonder, did we create monsters? Well, now, for sure we do. Victor Frankenstein does. So Victor Frankenstein is a med school dropout, not a doctor like he is in a lot of the film renditions. He's a brilliant young man who creates a theoretically ideal man. At this time in the 1800s, we're beginning to see, well, in the late 1700s too, we're beginning to see a whole lot of people wondering, well, now that we're getting rid of the control that religion has had over our culture, now that we're getting into rationality and science and a lot of industrial and technological progress, then what are we left with if we're not the sons of Adam and we're not guided by a received system of ethics and morality and beliefs? Well, aren't we kind of a blank slate now? Of course, no, none of us are a blank slate. We're born into all sorts of influences. But imagine that you were. Imagine that you did have a blank slate. In fact, imagine that rather than focusing on a religious resurrection, you can make a scientific resurrection. That's what Frankenstein does. He takes dead men, pieces them together, and creates his new resurrection. A new man who is smarter than normal men, who is stronger than normal men, maybe even smarter than all men alive, stronger than all men alive, a faster learner than everyone. This is as perfect as the top thinkers of this time could have imagined a human being. And what happens? Well, the creator cannot cope with his own creation. Here's the moment when he first sees his beautiful creation come to life. His limbs were in proportion, and I had selected his features as beautiful. Beautiful! Great God, his yellow skin scarcely covered the work of muscles and arteries beneath. His hair was of a lustrous black and flowing, his teeth of a pearly whiteness, but these luxuriances only formed a more horrid contrast with his watery eyes that seemed almost of the same color as the dun white sockets in which they were set, his shriveled complexion and straight black lips. Here we get this image of this thing that was perfect, theoretically perfect, proportionally perfect, and yet, or perhaps therefore, it's horrid to look upon. And that moment where Victor Frankenstein rejects his creation rather flippantly, like he runs off to take a nap and then to go hang out with his friends because he can't deal with it right now. He can't even. And he doesn't seem to care that he leaves this poor thing who is open-minded and open-hearted, looking for any type of guidance in his first few moments of life, it's so heartbreaking. It's pathetic. It's sad. It just cracks your heart in two. I have a hard time rereading it every time I get back to that part. It's a really sad book. And one thing after another ends up finding us with the creation chasing down his creator. And the brilliant setting for this one, the perfect setting for it, is the Arctic, where the creation finally catches up with the creator. And the Arctic at this point, especially in the 1800s, is the place that is that's the frayed limits of human exploration, really, the frayed limits of human achievement. In 2018, it would be set like in Mars, as far as we could possibly envision ourselves getting to. But in this time, it was the Arctic. And the Arctic is also a great place for this existential confrontation. I mean, it's blank, pure wilderness, and any human there is a human that has to look deep into what am I, this thing on this planet. So the dilemma of the monster in this story, it mirrors that of the dilemma of most of the thinkers at this era. Now that they have done away with the god of creation and the god of religion, then they're still stuck in a world that is somehow created, it has come to be, and it's imperfect, and it's full of suffering, and they want to know some answers. And now that they consider themselves superior to religion, then they're having to deal with that problem of what does it mean that I'm superior to this thing that made me? And that brings up a lot of anger, but sadness. And so in this story, the creature is wondering, who is this god of flawed creation, this flawed creation of ignorance, of suffering that I'm stuck in? And then he finds that he is superior to the thing that created him. And now his dilemma is, what does it mean that I am superior to my creator? I want to both kill him in vengeance, but I can't help but want to reconcile with him in some type of eternal peace. And that's the creature's great dilemma, also human beings' great dilemma at this time. Trivia tangent. See if you can figure out the answer before I give it to you. I have mentioned three authors so far who were famously blind. I mentioned two of them in this episode, one of them in the last episode. Which three authors were notably blind? I'll give you a second, and here comes the answer. The first was Homer, the next was John Milton, and the third was Jorge Borges. Did you get it? If so, that's impressive. Good job. Trivia tangent over. Let's jump to 1851 and one of the great monster hunting stories of all time, Moby Dick, or The White Whale. I prefer the subtitle, The White Whale. And that's by Herman Melville. It starts out with this epigraph.
In that day, the Lord with his sore and great and strong sword shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent, even Leviathan, that crooked serpent, and he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea.
That's from Isaiah. And after that, there's another epigraph, and after that one, another one, and another one, and another one, and another one, and I counted 79 of them, until we get to that famous first sentence, call me Ishmael. Of course, it's not the first sentence. There's this massive, epic buildup. It's really cool. If there was ever any need to conceive of Moby Dick as more than just a story about fishing, and in some ways it is just a story about fishing, but those epigraphs set you up for seeing this as something much bigger and much more cosmic. And in fact, if there's any reason to think that this book is much more than some sort of bored and overdone canonical classic that everybody has to just suffer their way through, all you have to do is pay attention to this thing. Moby Dick is freaking hilarious and horrifying, scene after scene. There's plenty of comedy. There's plenty of crazy horror. There's plenty of just ludicrous chapter after chapter, scene after scene. It's a wild ride. And in this, I would consider Moby Dick or the White Whale to be this great example of monsters. One that takes us straight into H.P. Lovecraft. That's our next episode. We're going to get into Lovecraft and the more modern writers. But, you know, it could be argued that no, everything else you've talked about, Monster Professor, has actually been a monster so far. This is actually just a type of whale. Well, that's what Ahab's right-hand man, Starbuck, argues. Here's a great moment where Ahab, who is hunting the white whale, explains exactly what he means by going after this white whale. So Starbuck's getting onto him like, look, man, it's just a whale. He says, vengeance on a dumb brute that simply smote thee from blindest instinct? Madness. To be enraged with a dumb thing, Captain Ahab, seems blasphemous. But Ahab says, hark ye yet again, a little lower layer. All visible objects, man, are but as pasteboard masks, but in each event, in the living act, the undoubted deed, there, some unknown but still reasoning thing, puts forth the moldings of its features from behind the unreasoning mask. If man will strike, strike through the mask. How can the prisoner reach outside except by thrusting through the wall? To me, the white whale is that wall, shoved nearer to me. Sometimes I think there's naught beyond, but 'tis enough. He tasks me, he heaps me, I see him in outrageous strength, with an inscrutable malice sinewing it. That inscrutable thing is chiefly what I hate, and be the white whale agent, or be the white whale principal, I will wreak that hate upon him. So here, not only are we seeing that this whale is much more than just an animal or a beast for Ahab, it's a true monster, but we're also seeing that this monster is not merely a monster. This is some type of large existential dilemma that he's having to face, or that he's forcing himself to face. So now I've gotten myself to AD 1897. With Dracula, and I have no problem speeding through Dracula way too fast, because he's gonna get his whole episode, at least vampires and Dracula, but maybe Dracula and all the renditions of Dracula deserve its own episode, so I'm gonna speed right through it, man. This thing, written by Bram Stoker, was based in large part off of Polidori's story, The Vampire. Polidori's story that came from that magical night in the Year Without Summer in which Frankenstein was also created. So Bram Stoker based it on that quite a bit, but also historical figure, Vlad the Impaler, and other types of vampire folklore. In fact, this vampire idea was still so obscure to a lot of people that the original title was Count Vampire, and it was still going to be a surprise at the moment in the book where you find out, oh, this thing's a vampire, what's that? Thankfully he changed it to Count Dracula. And this thing is strikingly modern. It's really a book that is mixed media. If it was like the equivalent in its time of having a hyperlinked book with video and embedded into it. And it takes on, for nearly the first time, a kind of scientific approach to monsters. One reason I think that it had such a great appeal is it's this perfect storm of old fears and new fears. You have these old fears of creatures of the night and curses, magic, ghouls, beasts, women who eat the young. Those are these like old world fears. But then you have all these new world fears that we're seeing in 1897 and beyond. Diseases of the blood, STDs. We're now, with new economies and industry, seeing old aristocracy subjugating progress and seducing young women. We have battles of science. We're dealing with the depths of insanity now. And you mix all of those together into one story, man, you have a hit. And that's what Bram Stoker did. I didn't do Dracula a whole lot of justice there, because we're going to see him more, but I think we at least got through stage three before we get right into the modern era. So let's call this one the end of stage three. So what do monsters mean in stage three? I think monster as personal and existential dilemma. At this day and age, we have this concept that the secret horrors of the universe, or horrors of life, or of God, or so, whatever you want to call it, they are somehow walled off from us until the monster is created, until the monster is confronted, or until he's welcomed into the house. Remember, Dracula can't get at you unless you welcome him in, right? That your creation can't strike back at you unless you create it first. The white whale can't destroy you unless you go after it. And only now is it possible for human beings to turn into the monster. But notice that in all the stories we've talked about before, the monster is a separate thing. Even when the lines began to blur in the medieval, late medieval Renaissance era, they were blurring, but they were still separate. But now, even if you die, you could get stitched back together and become a Frankenstein creation. You can be turned into a vampire, right? And so that leads us right into stage four that we're going to get into in our next episode. And if you're interested in seeing my take on monsters when I create them, then check out my novel, The Black Palace. It's available on Amazon.com right now. And in it, I have my version of just about every kind of iconic monster I can think of, but I do it my way. If you want to find out more about what I have going on, or if you have questions for me, or requests for more Monster Professor podcast episodes, then come check out my website, joshwoodsauthor.com. Drop me a question, drop me a request, let me know what you're thinking, or just check out what I'm up to right now. I hope you got some use out of this episode. I hope it works for you. Thank you again for listening to the Monster Professor.